Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, one of our occasional themes on American Variety is what I call dog days, in which we look at some aspect of the world of dogdom. I've been a dog owner for about 35 years. My wife and I aren't unusual in that. About 45% of American households have at least one dog. And when I say dog owner, that actually sounds a little harsh to my ears, especially when sometimes I feel more like the servant of the dog in the house as well as her best friend. So I sometimes say only half tongue-in-cheek that I'm a housemate of a dog, and indeed a wicked smart standard poodle in this case. One thing that always intrigued me about our dogs is the question of how much they understand of what we say. Do you ever find yourself spelling words like, you know, G-O for go or out or bath, in hopes of fooling your dog into not knowing what's coming up? And in fact, if they're really smart, they can figure out the spelling after a while. Well, it turns out there are people who study this. In the past, we've had on the show university researchers who study various aspects of what's called dog cognition. This week, we have as my guest Dr. Federico Rossano, an associate professor in the Department of Cognitive Science at the University of California, San Diego. And we're going to talk with him about something called button dogs, dogs who tap the buttons on soundboards with pre-recorded words such as walk, park, or mom, and react to those sounds. And the basic question is, with that kind of research, are they really communicating or are they just well-trained after a while? So the underlying question is really an exploration of how dogs relate to both the recorded voices and to the humans behind the voices. Welcome, Dr. Rossano.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Appreciate you being on. Can we call you Federico?
Absolutely.
Good. Well, tell us about your research. How do you conduct it and how long has it been going on? And in fact, I think it does not immediately right now involve the dogs pressing the buttons. So tell us about what you're doing.
So we started a large citizen science project 3 years ago. And this study that just got published is the first empirical paper of a series of studies we have already conducted and many more that we're planning on conducting. The general larger project, the Citizen Science Project, has about 10,000 participants from 47 different countries. And we've been tracking how these dogs are learning how to use the buttons, how they use it in interaction with humans, and of course, how do they seem to understand when humans push those buttons? So this first study was targeted at answering the first question, which is, do they even pay attention to those buttons and the words produced through them? And do they seem to understand them?
Yeah, so that was the title of your paper. How do soundboard-trained dogs respond to human button presses? An investigation into word comprehension. So what did you find out?
So the general finding is that, yes, they do pay attention to words, not just to body behavioral cues. And the general issue is that when you say outside or you say go, the dog definitely hears you, but sometimes might also respond to cues like you putting on your shoes or moving towards the door or approaching certain parts of the house at a certain time of the day. And so they can kind of infer what you might be doing next. So one of the big questions is like, do they really pay attention to the words? And is this something that only very special dogs can do, or is it something more common? So historically, there have been a couple of studies showing remarkable dogs that could learn hundreds of words. And of course, now we have thousands of people using these buttons, and we wanted to assess, is it even reasonable to assume that they pay attention to this word? So what we tried to do was running two studies, really. In the first case, we sent experimenters into people's homes. One of the experimenters put stickers on the button so that the other experimenter would not know what they're actually pressing and would move into another room with the dog owner. And then the second experimenter would be in the room with the buttons and the dog. The second experimenter would be wearing headphones and glasses so that they could not give away any cue. And of course, they couldn't hear what buttons they were pressing. And then they would press a button, stand still looking towards the dog, and wait for some time until they would proceed again to push the next button. And so what we were interested in seeing was, you know, if you push buttons associated with play or with outside or with food, do you see the dog producing a contextually appropriate behavior? So, for example, if you push play, would they go looking for a toy or would they try to engage in play with you? If you push outside, would they move towards the door, anticipating that they need to go outside? And not surprising, I think, for many people who have dogs, yes, they do it. But the critical part here was not the fact that they do associate this kind of sound to the activity, is the fact that this can be done without behavioral cues, and the fact that this can be done by a complete stranger pushing the buttons. So they're really paying attention to the sounds and not just to who is doing the signal. In the second study, we had the owners now saying the words, and we looked at what the dog would do. And then we had the owners press the buttons and see what the dog would do. And luckily for us, they kept doing the same thing. So it looks like they're paying attention to the words per se. They're not just looking at the soundboard and which specific button you're pushing. And they're not just looking for behavioral cues to kind of figure out what should be done next.
Yeah, so that's interesting. You kind of stripped away the body language dimension of communication, which would be in facial cues or the way somebody moves or the direction they're moving. And, you know, like you said, they're putting on the shoes or whatever,
right,
starting to open a door. So you strip it down to just the words, but you found that really the dogs react just as well to the words as to the words plus the body cues, right? So
exactly.
So it's interesting. You would have thought that the physical cues would have been at least as important as the words, but I guess not. So this is interesting.
Well, at least in the case of buttons, right? So we're just like, we were trying to sort of assess, do they even pay attention to these devices? Because of course you could imagine that, you know, we see them as devices that could be used for communication, but it might just be that they're toys, right? So I have a 2-year-old that plays with a keyboard, but it's not playing music. It's just like, you know, smashing of buttons and hearing noise. And from his perspective, he doesn't think about music. It just thinks about, he wants to make noise, and then he gets people to comment on it, and that makes him happy. So in the same way, you can imagine the dog doing that with this button. So, and maybe that, in principle, that could have been all that was going on.
Do you do anything with the recordings where, you know, and again, been a dog owner for half my life, right? So a lot of the reaction that a dog has to what you say is in the emotional content of it, whether you say it with excitement or kind of a question versus a command, or whether it's kind of positive versus negative sound, you know. So do you try to eliminate that in your recordings and make them just flat, or do you include those kind of emotional cues?
So in the current study, what we did is we just used the recordings with the sound produced by the owners, so that they would be familiar with that voice. But this means that there's quite a bit of a range, right? So some people might record themselves saying outside, and other people just be like, outside. So in that sense, we did not quite control for the intonation in the buttons and how they were produced. And that's definitely a good next step, to sort of be a little more careful. Because we know that just like there's child-directed speech, and that's what children pay attention to, there is dog-directed speech. And dogs seem to tune into whether they think you're talking to them, or whether they can tell you're just talking to another human from the intonation you're using.
Yeah, so I guess that's kind of the upside of the huge population that you had participate in your study, is that it's huge and you have a large database to work from. But the downside is that you can't control the parameters of the data you're getting like you can in a lab. So it's kind of good and
exactly.
bad.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is kind of, you know, the blessing and the curse at the same time. You know, some people ask me, why didn't you start with a much more controlled training program, which was what was done, for example, in the past with other animal species, like great apes, like chimpanzees and gorillas, bonobos. And the reason was that I did not know what would work. And I was like, you know, one way of making observation and doing science is you first go out there into the wild, see what happens, and then you might detect what seemed to be working best. And once you track it, then you can develop a training study or an experiment and see, does this actually work better than the other way? So what we wanted to start with was, you know, let's just observe what's happening. And the beauty of having 10,000 dogs is that you can detect outliers, right? So there will be lots of dogs that barely use the buttons, maybe even struggle learning. And then you have some that have more than 100 buttons that they use on a regular basis. And so then the question is, what's going on with those few that seem to be so remarkable? And can we learn something from how they got trained, when they started the training, what's going on in their households, any other variable that could be like temperament or breed or whatever feature that could possibly help us predict success, and then test it. So those are definitely steps that we are planning on doing in the continuation of this project.
Yeah, that was one thing I wanted to ask you, is whether you see that there are breed differences. I mean, I would think that there'd be a big difference between a border collie and a, oh, I don't know, like an Irish setter or a basset hound in terms of their communicability.
There are definitely differences, and we are starting to track them, some of them. The interesting thing, though, is that historically, when you do studies on language comprehension, border collies were the stars of the game. And in our study, while they're good, they're not the better ones. So we actually have poodles, for example, are remarkably good. We have terriers that seem to be good. We have a lot of mutts, so a lot of mixed breed that are very good. And, you know, border collies are up there, but you can imagine if to use a device to interact with a human, you need to want to interact with a human. And so probably if your dog breed is a watchdog that lives outside and is chasing people away from your land, probably they're not going to have a lot of motivation to start chatting with you. On the other hand, if you live in the house or if you spend more time, you know, if you were selected as a companion through domestication, then probably you might have a bigger motivation to communicate or at least try to learn how to interact with your human to get the kind of things you want.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So I think one thing you looked at is whether dogs react the same way to the same words when they're spoken by other people who are not their owners. What did you find there?
When the buttons are pressed by other people that are not their owners, the answer is they respond exactly the same way.
So it's not a difference in the recording. It's just the person pressing the button.
Versus the owner saying it or pushing the same button, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I've never done any button pressing with our dogs, but, you know, we talked about breed just a second ago. And one miniature schnauzer, a male, we had 20 years or so ago. He was what our vet called very cerebral, right? And I once counted up the words he could clearly understand, and I came up with 20 words. He could even comprehend simple sentences. For example, if I was at my desk working and he came over and brushed his chin whiskers against my leg to get my attention, which is what he would do, and gave me a certain begging look, I knew he wanted a what we called a goodie or a treat, you know. And if I was too busy to do it, I would tell him, "Rudy, go get Mama Dog, give Rudy goodie." And he would jump to attention, wheel around, and run off to the other side of the house where I could hear him whining or barking and my wife laughing and saying, "Okay, okay, all right," and she would do what he wanted. Is that kind of complex sentence understanding unusual that you find?
Yes and no. So I think if you ask most dog owners, they would tell you that their dogs understand quite a few words. Indeed, we have evidence scientifically that we have some dogs that got to show that they could understand up to 1,000 words. It's not very common to get to that level. Most dogs are probably within the range of 30 to 80, I would say. But what is an interesting question, that's why I said it depends how you look at it, is to what degree they go beyond understanding nouns, right? So, you know, understanding things like cup, bowl, or commands like fetch, sit, that's not impossible. Whether they understand sentences, so whether they follow your syntax, whether they understand the difference between give mom this versus give dad this, that is something to be tested. So there's claims on a couple of dogs that seem to be able to pass this kind of test, but that's what we definitely want to test in our larger pool size so that we can actually see how far can their syntactic abilities, in a sense, go, if they have any, of course.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Dr. Federico Rossano, who's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego, and who researches communication in dogs. So we're talking about some experiments that he runs in the long term and recently as well. And I read that learning object names may be more challenging to dogs than learning words associated with actions. Objects are harder for them to get than actions. But I noticed that if we say to our current dog, "Go get your baby," she'll run all over the house looking for a certain toy that we call your baby. So that's an action, but the object of the action is an object of the toy, right? So right. What do you think about that? Does that conflict with that idea of object versus action?
So I think the claim is, as far as we know, true, which means you can train a dog with basic commands. Pretty much every dog can be trained with that, and, you know, as any trainer can tell you. But it's not that easy for them to be able to learn the names of new objects, or at least to go beyond a certain number of words. So what the scientists are referring to here is the idea that, for example, you know, we had these dogs that I was saying could show that they knew hundreds of nouns. And so the task would be something like, I'm in one room, the dog comes to me and I say, go fetch the ball. And then they go into the other room and get the ball. Go fetch the baby, as you were saying. And then they go fetch the correct ball. But once they try to do it on like pet dogs, nobody could actually do it. So the average pet dog could not do it. And then they tried to do it, and meaning an experimenter coming into a room and tried to sort of ask you to do this, or could not do it reliably. And then when they tried to run a kind of a citizen science project, trying to find how many dogs out there could do it, and they had hundreds of people trying to run this test at home, and they found that 6 dogs could do it out of hundreds that had tried. So it's not impossible, but it's just like, you know, how far can you go with kind of expanding your vocabulary in terms of names of objects?
Yeah.
If you think about it from an ecological point of view, it's not really surprising because most animals are not really sort of designed to interact with human artifacts. I mean, obviously, dogs live with humans, but, you know, animals in nature don't really interact with a lot of toys or a lot of other things. So actions, behaviors, and how to sort of interact with the environment is almost more important than which specific object are you referring to when you call for X, Y, Z. And so it's not really surprising that they don't necessarily learn names of objects easily. It doesn't mean it's impossible. It just means that it's kind of a rare skill. But we know that they can learn commands, and that's sort of pretty clear from everything we know.
Yeah, so you mentioned, you know, their evolution. And of course, these domesticated dogs are only a snap of your finger away from being wild dogs several hundred or a thousand years or so ago before they became kind of the companions of humans. So one thing that I found interesting in your study is that dogs did not show food-related behaviors in response to food-related words. And you speculated that maybe they weren't hungry or didn't expect food outside of their usual feeding times. But I've always found that they're pretty food-oriented. And that when I call out, you know, Callie, when I'm making her food, she'll usually show up right away. Now, I guess you would say that's because she knows that's eating time or whatever. But but if I ask her, do you want a goodie at some other point, she'll go to the jar we keep them in and look up at it, you know. So were you surprised not to find that connection with food, which you'd think would be pretty high on their wish list?
I was partly surprised because I did, just like you, think that food is a big motivator. But there's a but here, which is, we also know that the dogs that do better at learning how to use these buttons are usually not food-motivated dogs. They're mainly praise-motivated or play-motivated. The ones who are mainly food-motivated tend to struggle because they kind of give up real quick. And so it's almost like the fact that you are interacting with this device and the fact that we run a study with animals that have been trained with this device, it could be a selection bias, right? That you have already selected for animals that the ones who can learn it might be not quite as food motivated as other dogs, which doesn't mean that they don't care about food. Obviously they do, but they might be more motivated by something like let's play or let's go out for a walk and spending time with the humans and just trying to sort of interact rather than I use the human as a vending machine, right? So I'm just trying to get food from you at all times. And, yeah. And that's what I'm doing. The other thing, is true, is that, you know, a lot of dogs in households don't just get fed at any time of day by anybody, right? So for example, you know, if the expectation in our study was, if I push the button food, would you approach like your bowl or the fridge or whatever, the cupboard where the owner might keep the food? But if you have a stranger pushing that button, you might just look at the stranger kind of like, okay, I'm waiting, give me some food. Like, you know, if you have never been in my house, how would I know where the food that you're going to give me? So there could be a little more like, I just don't know what's going to happen here, or it's unexpected, right? It's like, are you going to give me something? Do you have something in your pocket that I'm waiting for? Because the data was actually coded without audio by other research assistants that were not in the household, we had a very specific list of behaviors that we were tracking. And the fact that you find less food-related behaviors in this kind of scenario is partly surprising and partly not, as I said, because we might have been underestimating that they might have thought they were going to get food directly from the experiment and they might just stand looking at the experiment and waiting for it.
I get it. It's complicated. So
I guess that's the easy answer that I should give. It's complicated.
So I think we've all done the thing where you're with your dog and you have someone else the dog knows well, like your spouse, on the phone. And you hold the phone up to the dog's ear while the other person says hi, you know, to the dog in an animated way. And typically I find that the dog cocks its head and appears interested, but maybe kind of confused. They don't really wag their tail and try to speak back to the phone or whatever. In your past research, have you looked at that particular interaction at all?
We have not looked at that interaction yet, but of course you can imagine that pushing buttons where there's words recorded by a person when that person is not in the household could potentially be puzzling, right? It's like if you have recorded all the words and then now you're outside the house and your spouse is pushing the buttons and the words that come out with your voice, one could imagine that the dog could be a little puzzled by that. We haven't really noticed anything specific about this, but it is definitely something we should look more into. What we do know is in some households, both, let's say, parents, human parents, might record different buttons that might be more related to activities they engage in. And so it is kind of interesting how you could almost imagine that they might be, just by hearing your voice, they might think it must be more of this kind of activities rather than those kind of activities, because with you, mm-hmm. I go out and play, and with the other one is the one who feeds me, for example, or things like that.
And of course, these are dogs who are not used to the whole button pushing regimen, so it's a weird thing to them. I mean, they look at it like that's weird, you know, like
right. The example I always give, it's always like think about a little child, right? Think about a two-year-old that hears a voice on the phone. It's like they're kind of looking around. It's like, where are you? What? Come here. Where are you? So there's like, it is a little magic, right? After all, telephones joined our society only about 150 years ago or so.
That's right.
So it's a newer thing. It's a new adaptation. So I can imagine why it could be puzzling for a non-human animal.
Just quickly, it's a different thing from communication, but that same dog that I mentioned earlier, who was very cerebral, was totally attuned to animals on TV, even if they're cartoon animals. And if he saw a dog, you know, way in the background walking down the sidewalk, not in the foreground of the picture at all, he would run up to the entertainment center and try to, like, look behind the TV. Like, he thought the dog might be back at, you know, so some of these dogs are pretty amazing what they do think about
absolutely.
From the standpoint of someone who can't understand the technology, right?
Absolutely. And at the same time, you know, this is one of the tests that a lot of people have run in terms of self-recognition, right? So one of the claims is that an 18-month-old can look at herself in the mirror and recognize that's her and therefore, you know, not be puzzled. But if you put a younger kid in front of a mirror, they would just be looking for, you know, thinking there's another child they're interacting with or looking for it behind. And we know that several animals can recognize themselves in the mirror. Dogs are interesting that way because on one end, it looks like they can't really recognize themselves in the mirror. And then on the other end, it looks like they recognize their own smell. And so, of course, does it mean that they have a sense of self? It's like, I've been here before, or imagining themselves in an extended way beyond their own body. So they kind of, there's a bit of debate to what degree they have a sense of self that they can generalize to the point of recognizing themselves or imagining themselves in different moments in time, for example.
You know, you mentioned dogs that can understand hundreds of words or whatever. What would you say is the largest vocabulary of human words that a dog can have or that any dog has ever had, if that's a fair question to ask?
Well, as far as we know, the maximum that has been documented is by a dog that has been shown to have 1,022 words.
Wow.
These were nouns. And so you can imagine even just knowing the name of 1,022 objects or items is remarkable. A lot of them were like different type of balls or different types of containers or different types of dolls. And it's still, you know, not remarkable compared to a 4-year-old human. But 1,000 words, of course, become exciting if you can imagine, you know, what can you communicate if you can also add some verbs in there, right? After all, we said that they do understand commands. And so it wouldn't be surprising for them to be able to understand some kind of verbs. And this is actually something we're looking into another study that we currently have under review, where we're looking at, do they combine buttons together to basically do what, for example, a toddler would do when they do those two-word sentences or three-word sentences. right? So that you can say, want milk, want water, want food. And if you can start showing that they can actually do that, now you can imagine, you know, you can start expanding the communicative potential that you have by combinatorics, right? By being able to combining different buttons to convey different meanings. Now, of course, is that something they can do? Well, we know humans can do it, but our task is to figure out, do they just reproduce what they've been trained on? In which case, it's not really remarkable. It's impressive that they can learn it, but not cognitively remarkable that they can learn it. After all, a pigeon can learn to associate sounds to objects. But it could be remarkable if we show, if we can find any flexibility in the sense that, like, if I train you, for example, on want food, and then at some point you start pushing the button want associated with other things you might want, like want play, want outside, want water. And if you can do it without having been trained on it, then, of course, it shows that you have some kind of understanding of what kind of things you can want and probably some understanding of what want means, right?
Well, Federico, we just have a minute or so left, but if I can ask you just to kind of think off the top of your head, what's maybe one of the most amazing things you've seen an individual dog do or dogs do from a communication standpoint?
Well, what I've seen them do is communicate about their pain and then later displaying that this was real. So things like saying belly ouch and then puking 20 minutes later. Or ear ouch, and then go to the vet and discover that they have an ear infection. I think that we always think of them responding to us by giving them a tool to tell us what they need, not just the food they want, but also that they might be sometimes frustrated or in pain, or they might be going through something, could improve their welfare in remarkable ways. And so I'm excited to dig more into this and figure out how far can this go.
Well, I hope you can figure out some of that, because I don't know how many times, you know, my wife and I have said to each other, I'd pay $5,000 a year for our dog to be able to talk fluently to us for 1 minute every month or something like that, you know, because it would save a lot of vet bills and that kind of thing, you know, because sometimes you're spending a lot on tests and you're just probing around trying to figure out something that's kind of obscure, you know, so.
If I can add this, you know, when I, a lot of people think that what we're doing is we're looking into whether dogs can learn language, they can have syntax and do all this window into their minds. But a lot of people participating were like, we're not really interested in that. What we're interested in is exactly like, I want to be able to provide for them so that when they are in pain, I can help them. And when they need something, I can provide it. And I think the idea that maybe this could be a tool to convey what's going on and when you are in pain before we would naturally detect it, I think it's very powerful. And I hope that this proves to be the case.
Well, that would be wonderful. We're going to have to leave it there. But to learn more about Dr. Rossano's research and maybe even volunteer to be a citizen scientist in his research group, go to his Comparative Canine Cognition Lab website at cclab.ucsd.edu. Well, Dr. Federico Rossano, thank you so much for being on with us here on American Variety. It's been interesting.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.